Welcome back to the Fastest Known Podcast. Gosh, it feels like I'm back with old friends. Even though I don't really see people in person very much, I feel like I'm talking with my friends. I don't feel like I'm really sitting in my closet like I actually am. Instead, today I'm talking with my good friend and often co-host, Hillary Allen. Welcome, Hillary.
Hey, Buzz. So happy to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to be on the show again with you. And I'm going to give you a little more introduction than I normally do. Because our topic for today is bad training advice, which is a big topic. It's kind of an easy topic. We can go on for hours and hours. But you are qualified on this one because you are currently a coach for Charmin Ultra Coaching. That would be Ian Charmin, who's won Leadville 100 multiple times. And you, of course, wrote a book. I'm going to link to this in the written show notes. And so you have really had to pull yourself back from the brink. I mean, you had, you know, literally life-threatening injuries. And so that gives you a lot of credibility and knowledge on training advice. And also, your coaching background goes way back. I'm quoting from your website. You pursued a degree in organic chemistry, then earned a master's degree in neuroscience and physiology and structural biology from the University of Colorado. So I'm just going to editorialize here. There's a lot of coaches out there, and sometimes they're just people who have run a lot and have no other credential. I personally find that a little alarming, but you do have academic credentials, which I appreciate.
Thank you. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I do think you gained a lot of experience from coaching through actually running and racing. So I think that that's something obviously that, you know, certain runners, like, I don't know if I would respect them as much as a coach if they didn't run themselves, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be this great coach. I think you have to have a balance and kind of understand the science. And, you know, I've spent some time before working with Charmin Ultra, I was coaching over at CTS and, you know, had undergone some training over there for coaching. And even before then, I had, you know, done different coaching outside of, you know, an official kind of company and have done a lot of reading. I'm a super nerd. So I think I order a bunch of like training books and I really like to learn. And actually, you know, when I was coming back from the brink of my injury is when I learned a lot about coaching in particular, how to diversify yourself as a runner. And I think I almost debunked a lot of kind of training myths that I held in my mind, kind of in learning through that process. So, yeah.
Well, let's hear some of these training myths. Let's just start with you. What do you hear a lot that you just don't think is right?
You know, so one of the first things that I thought of when I first started running was that you have to run like hundreds and hundreds of miles a week in order to prepare yourself for running these long distance races in the mountains. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend that right away. And I don't think I would actually recommend it in general, because I think running is very hard on your body. And the more that I've gotten into running, you know, I'm not a runner that runs 100 miles a week. I run maybe 70 on average in my peak training weeks. And I supplement that with a lot of other stuff. And I think I've been some of the fittest I've ever been.
Well, that's a good call. That is a huge part of the sport, particularly ultra sport, is high volume, run forever. And of course, there's certain people in the sport who've done that. And then 3 years later, they're not doing that. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I definitely know that. And I think there's certain people that can get away with it. And I think arguably, if you look kind of throughout the history of ultra running, men can get away with it for longer periods of time than maybe women. But I think at one point, I think I've always called it like a 2 year kind of flame for women in the sport who run an insane amount of miles, train a whole bunch, and then, you know, have 2 years of good performances, and then they just can't maintain it anymore. And then they have to really kind of change. I mean, But yeah, I think it's really sexy in ultra running to think that, oh, well, we're running these long distances. We have to spend all of these hours and all of these miles on our feet all of the time to prepare. And there's this whole idea of like one of my least favorite bad training advice is more is better. And specifically more running is better. And there's two things we can kind of talk about that, but I disagree. So I'll let you take the first stop at that one. What do you think, Buzz? Is more better?
No. I think the science on that is kind of tuned itself up, hasn't it? I think most coaches are not into that. David Roach has been doing a lot of articles recently for Trail Runner magazine. He's become somewhat prominent, and he trains some ultra runners as well as marathon runners. And he just doesn't do that. He notes that you really have to recover from each effort in order to have the training adaptation take place. If you don't recover from the efforts, then there is no training adaptation. You just get tired, which isn't the same thing. And I also noticed that Eliud Kipchoge, you know, the world's best marathoner in history, after a marathon, he takes like a month off. And then he starts off doing just some exercises. It's very interesting. So it's kind of fun reading that more is not better. So here's something that I've been noticing. I've been hearing a little bit about is that people, not just more is better, but just running as well. And so it's kind of interesting. Obviously, you have to be specific. You have to be specific at what you do. If you want to run roads, you really should practice on roads, mountains. But there's this aspect about technique. Every other sport, you practice technique. Isn't that interesting? Every other sport I'm aware of, you know, it's from basketball to tennis. I do a lot of paddling. Boy, I work on form all the time. And running, people don't work on form. They tend to just run. So it becomes this pure cardiovascular test. But I think that's it's kind of missing something there, because there's a tremendous amount of efficiency gained through efficient stride and the neuromuscular response there. For example, if you're going downhill, up to from 50 to 75% of your energy is braking, slowing yourself down. Now, if you had really good form and you could reduce that to 20 to 50%, look at how much energy you would save. And so I think working on technique and form in running is actually fairly important.
Yeah. And, you know, so something that I think that's a great point. And I think especially early on in my running career is something I didn't even really focus on, right? It's like running can be so natural, but you don't know until you get these almost, you know, these injuries that something might be off. And I think it's running form, but I think it also goes into kind of strength training. I know, Buzz, you and I both really, really like that. But I mean, I think of all of the track runners, like they're doing drills, they're doing like warm ups every time before they go out for a speed work. And why aren't ultra runners doing that? Now, you know, I've read a lot of articles about the importance of like stretching, like having, you know, full range of motion and, you know, flexibility of your muscles. And the data, it's kind of a toss up, like whether stretching actually does, you know, benefit, especially endurance runners, because we benefit from having kind of a more compact stride, right? We don't need the full springiness or the full range of motion because we're not running super fast like sprinters do. So maybe we need a little bit less kind of perfect form, right? Because our form breaks down over time. But I do think it's really important. And I do think that the longevity of a runner and their career can actually increase if they incorporate, you know, proper form, but also like mobility and also strength training. And I think for me, that's where my running changed, because as soon as I started to incorporate strength, I remember my physical therapist, my PT, he like at first when I came in there, I didn't know how to properly like do a one-legged squat. And running is just a series of jumps and one-legged motions. And I was putting extra strain, not really using my hips or my glutes, which are the biggest muscle group in the body. So unless you know how to do that and isolate it in the gym, how are you supposed to do it when you're getting tired at mile 50 in a 100-mile race? So, you know, I think I think generally speaking, if from an hours perspective or a miles perspective in training, if you can, you know, spend 20% less time running and replace that with strength work, I think you're going to be faster at running and better at it.
Do you think this is more or the same level of importance for females as it is for males?
I actually think it's more important for females because we don't have as much muscle mass as men do. And I also think that after a woman turns about 30, like generally speaking, bone mass actually starts to kind of decrease as well as muscle mass. And so the really running, right, it's not enough to maintain that structural, like that pull and that strain on the muscles, especially the axial spine. So that's lifting weights above, you know, on your shoulders, like squats, like, you know, things like that, that kind of load the axial spine, pull-ups, that kind of stuff is really important for, especially for women. And because we don't have as much muscle mass in general, and I think it just helps you stay stronger, longer, and also in kind of longer in, you know, the relative sense of as running a race as well.
Right. Well, speaking from a person of the older persuasion, as we may gently call it, yeah, times two, because there's a particular enzyme that processes protein and develops muscle. And as anyone gets older of any gender, that enzyme decreases in your bloodstream. You have less of it. And so you are utilizing less protein. So you have to do, well, probably two things: intake more protein dietarily, but also absolutely work on strength. When I was younger, I never did it, partially because I didn't like to do it. I really liked to run, so we do what we like. But boy, after about starting about 15 years ago, I go to the gym every winter, and it's a big deal. And I actually feel pretty good in the spring, and sometimes by fall, not so much because I don't go in the gym during the season. So I agree. I think strength training, and you just mentioned, is probably more important for females. And as you age, it becomes extremely important.
Yeah.
Some factors maintain with age, but strength and pliability are two that plummet.
Right. And I think also, like you said, I mean, as you're talking like 15 years ago, so what, you're like, you know, 45. Right. and also I think it's exactly what you're talking about with form. If you actually have muscles to support yourself, like some of the most common things I see, this might sound like I'm like judgmental on the trails, but if I see someone running and I see their knees caving inward, like some of that can be improper running form, but a main indication, it's weak glutes. And runners are like, you know, I have some big quads. You've seen my quads, right, Buzz?
Yep.
I have muscles, but like,
I've seen your quads as you're pedaling away from me on the uphills.
Yeah. And, but I also have a butt. So maybe you just don't answer that question, Buzz, if I have a butt. But like the glutes are really important. And I think runners are notorious for having tiny butts and these huge quads. And that means that they're overcompensating. And it's like, if you learn how to use your glutes, which are a very important muscle group and very important for running, and to have a natural running form, you need to like go see your PT and get in the gym and figure out how to do a proper squat, and especially like a single leg one too.
This is good. So we have strength just as injury prevention and for ultras to keep you, you know, maintaining good form late in an event. But also there's the imbalances. There's a technical aspect to strength. You've identified a few things, like glutes are a classic one. A lot of runners get upper hamstring injuries, don't they? They get that tendinosis in the upper hamstring, and they might roll on the ball. They might get a foam roller. But really what helps that one is to engage the glute. So you're taking that strain off of it. And so you're rotating not like from, you know, down kind of below your crotch, but you've got a little more rotation from your waist. So you're engaged your pelvis there. And that, you mentioned PT here a couple of times, Hillary. So you went to someone who could analyze this, and I'm guessing gave you a set of exercises to help balance out your strength profile.
Right. And this is, you know, this is like a gait analysis, right? And working with someone, and I had certain injuries. So like, you know, figuring out how I could, you know, and like work through around those injuries and then deal with muscle compensations that were causing something. So yeah, it's kind of the gait analysis is a really important thing there. And yeah, I mean, like we mentioned, like, you know, injury prevention and this whole thing. I think it's really important to know. I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, some of the best marathoners in the world, they're taking like months off after a race. Well, usually the best marathoners, they're only racing twice in a year. And ultra marathoners, like we have this mentality that we need to race like, you know, 500 mile races in a year in order for, you know, we can do that all year. And we're chasing this like fitness to be in top form at all points in the year. And I think that that's just not realistic. And so something that I think is, you know, a good training habit is to kind of have an off season and during that off season to lift more heavy weights. And it's okay if you gain more muscle mass. Like if you're lifting heavy weights, like that's the point. And then when you start putting in more miles, when you're running more miles in the summer, like that extra kind of muscle that you put on kind of generally, you just run it off basically. But it's good to have a building portion of the year and a like, you know, running long distances, it breaks muscle down. So like you can't have that year round because then you're just going to get into kind of energy deficiency and I think overtraining. So yeah.
Right. Interesting. So there's four things. Gosh, we're shooting right along here. One, you mentioned that more might not be always better. And then I mentioned technique, that runners tend to just run. That's all they do, run. And they're just training their cardiovascular systems instead of training their technique, which essentially all other sports do. And then thirdly, we mentioned strength training being part of running. Particularly good for females. I mentioned particularly good for people who are beyond the age of fill in the blank, but certainly beyond the age of 40. I mean, just technically, scientifically speaking, your strength will decrease dramatically. And then you just brought up periodization, which is most top people don't go the same all year round. And that's also, I should just add, kind of emotional and mental also, isn't it? It's not just physical. It's like you kind of need to emotionally just take your foot off the gas sometimes. Well, not.
I certainly do. I don't like that. And that's, I think this kind of gets into the next thing that I always hear is that just because I'm a runner, I can only run and I only need to run. And like we mentioned, you know, taking off the load, like I like to break up my year with skiing, with cycling, with doing like spending more time inside when it's dark outside and, you know, like getting into the gym rat routine. I like it. And, you know, I think that something that really helped me and transformed me was, okay, I'm not a runner. I've never defined myself as a runner. I was a tennis player. Like before I got into all of this, I played all sorts.
Oh, Hillary, you're disclosing this on air. Wow.
So I know.
Is social media going to light up after this podcast?
I don't know.
Hillary doesn't define herself as a runner. Oh no.
I know. Maybe they will. But you know what? I challenge you because like at the same time, it's like I have never identified myself as a runner only because I identify myself as an athlete. And I think that's right. Even more empowering because then if you're an athlete, you can do all of these other things and it's kind of giving yourself permission to explore these other sports. And, you know, then training is just training, right? And you're spending time outside doing sports and activity as you being an athlete is instead of getting stressed out that, oh my gosh, I'm not running today, then I'm not training or I'm not preparing for this race. Well, you know, that I think is just the wrong mentality to have. And I think it can kind of get you in trouble. It's gotten me in trouble in the past where then, you know, maybe I did too much. Like if I rode my bike a day, it wasn't enough. I had to go run too. And that's like, you know, that's not it. It's like something that also feeds the soul with this, like
right.
Having fun on a bike.
Right. And for FKT of the year, you and I both talked to Anna Troop, who is the oldest in the top 10, by the way. And she said something on air that we both pricked up our ear. She said she does her hard training on the bike because she can log the long, hard miles and you get off the bike, you actually feel fine. And if she tried to do at her age the long hard miles on foot, she's going to break down. So that was an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that I use the bike trainer. I love to like to sweat it out on a bike trainer hard workout. And I think that's like, I train a lot of masters runners and, you know, you lose foot speed. Like that's just what ends up happening as you age. And so if you can replace that and really get your heart rate up, you know, on a bike trainer or like on the bike, you get the benefit of a hard cardiovascular workout without the impact. And I think it's just a win-win.
Nice. Well, you didn't buy Peloton stock, did you?
No, I did not. I use Zwift with an actual real bike.
Well, good. Because you would have lost 74% of your value if you had. So you're a smart lady. I appreciate that. So only run. And there's this person. You might have heard of him. He's from Catalonia. His first name is Killian. He lives in Norway now. And, of course, he just skied, right? He was Skimo guy all winter long, and then he did pretty well on the trails when he got back into it. And when he was doing some of the, for him, faster things, you know, like the Mont Blanc Marathon and things like that, and Zagama, you know, he would do some running specific. You know, he'd have to really focus on turnover to get ready for that. But his focus meant 6 weeks, while during the winter season, he was doing Skimo.
And I think Ashley Killian, you know, yes, I have heard of him. He himself wouldn't define himself as a runner, right? I think he's like a mountain athlete. And I think he, you know, he may be a skier because that's how he kind of got into it, a ski alpinist. You know, I can't speak for Killian, but I've heard him say this in several interviews. So, yeah, I think, you know, diversifying yourself is probably the best thing you can do.
Well, thanks for saying that. That's kind of interesting because I've never mentioned this, but I too have never defined myself as a runner, even though I'm somewhat known that. I always define myself actually as an adventurer. That's actually
love
my
that.
Forte.
You are a very good adventurer. We've had some epic adventures together, Buzz.
Well,
and
you've
pawned me off on some expert adventurers themselves, Jared Campbell and Luke Nelson. I had an adventure in Zion actually like a year ago today. It was great. But yeah, I mean, that is first and foremost. Like I was actually talking about this today. It's like, am I really a sponsored runner? Like, I really don't feel that like I train like any other athlete because I just want to go out and adventure and, you know, like create new routes, combine sports, have long days out there. And turns out you get pretty fit when you do that.
Right. And I will say, as I mentioned with Killian, when coming up on a race, I focus. And I'll do whatever it takes. So if I'm coming up on something, I will literally, I'm going to divulge the truth. I will get on a track and do yassos. I'll do some 800 meters, not for intensity, not really for speed, but just to get the biomechanics down. You know what I mean? So I got the turnover down. I'll do that like two or three times. You don't need to do that very much unless you're a, you know, 5 or 10K guy, then you kind of do. But for what we do, I'll do that two or three times just to get my biomechanics going.
Yeah, I really like that. And same here. Like I will focus for a race. Like I'll do specific workouts, obviously specific long runs, but I don't do that year round. And I think for me, it's like the more you're a runner and the more you run, like, and the more you're an endurance athlete, the more base that you have. So, you know, it's like more of a tune up. I don't think I need more than 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
Right. Right. And what you get from the style that you have, in my opinion, is longevity. So if someone just has this goal and just has that that marathon training is really the ultimate. You know, you mentioned ultra training, which is miles and miles. Marathoners make that look relaxed. You know, they don't walk out the door unless they're looking at their watch. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit.
I don't think so.
But it's hard to keep that up for a long period of time. You know, I've met some, you know, living in Boulder, met some literally world-class, world record holders who quit. They got a world record, and then 2 years later, they weren't running at all. Well, what you were describing, what I'm describing, my gosh, we're still doing it. And so there's a certain aspect, as Joseph Campbell said, of, you know, follow your bliss, you know, do what you love, actually is not bad training advice.
You know, and I think there's been, I mean, if we've looked at some of like the American record for the marathon, right, that just got broken, Kira D'Amato, she took a huge hiatus from running because she got burnt out from it. She had a really bad experience in college and in high school from coaches. And I think just that grind, I mean, Ryan Hall, the best male American marathoner of all time, he is now like a professional bodybuilder.
have you seen a photo of Ryan?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have.
It's insane. But it's not pinned up on your bedroom wall, is it?
Well, maybe on the ceiling of my van. but, you know, something like that, I think it is. And he's spoken outwardly and openly about it, that, you know, he had an eating disorder because he was constantly concerned about like power to weight ratio. I mean, that might be another bad training advice that I have, is that, you know, in ultra running, more is better from a miles standpoint, but then more is better. And then at the same time, less is more when it comes to nutrition and eating. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the worst idea and worst combination ever.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, if people are doubting what we're saying, you could Google photo of Ryan. He looks a little different than he looked when he did that 204 at Boston. And he says he feels great, by the way. But yeah, that's what's working for him. And he still trains his wife, Sarah, who's a right. total crusher.
Oh, yeah.
And she doesn't have the bodybuilder physique right now. So she still has that lightweight marathon physique. So, right. you know, it's your phase of life, what you want to pursue. And so what do you think about diet then? So you're thinking that the starvation diet is not that great of an idea, or what are you saying here?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, maybe you can get away with it from a little bit, but you're either going to end up quitting, being very depressed, or like angry and hangry all the time. And I think in the end, it doesn't really lead to longevity in sport. And for me, I want to be an adventurer. I want to be an athlete. I want to be a runner my whole life. And, you know, you need to adequately fuel for these endeavors.
Right. Come to think, I have a little side story here, which I didn't forget. One of our early rides together, that da-da-da-da, let's meet here, da-da-da. And you said, great. And there will be candy. I mean, that's literally what you said. You didn't say, well, are we going to bring arm warmers? Are we going to bring toe warmers? Are we going to bring water? No, you said, there will be candy. And so it's like, wow. This person's got her priorities sorted out for the day.
Well, also because I know with you, Buzz, even if we're going to ride by a coffee shop, we're not stopping. So I better bring stuff. I better bring right. snacks. So well, you have to also respect yeah. the ride.
Yeah, stopping, right. We all have our different styles, and somehow stopping is, Well, at any rate, we'll just let that one go. That'll be a different podcast.
Okay.
We'll explore that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would love to, but I also think it's so different between men and women. Women and men, how we deal with nutrition is just so much different. And I think if women try to mimic what men do, it can lead down kind of a, you know, bad path, because our physiology is just different.
Well, let's elaborate on that. That's a very good point. How would it be different? So for a woman listening to this podcast, what would you like to tell them?
To not fast, do fasted runs, like point blank. I think, you know, there's a point to it, and it's, you know, to train yourself to be like fat adapted. Right. But women already metabolize fat. We have a higher fat percentage in our bodies. It's one of the main differences in our physiology and our body, like our body makeup, body composition makeup. You know, and that's from elite female, you know, down to not an elite female athlete. But yeah, we metabolize fat better because we have fat, like, you know, in our blood available as a substrate to use as an energy source more so than men do. And so we don't really need that trainability. Of course, you can train it. You need to use fat for fuel, you know, when you're running these ultra endurance races. However, you can accomplish that in a 2-hour run, even if you eat breakfast before. So.
Gotcha. Interesting. Well, that was very well spoken. That was very informative. I appreciated that difference. I run a fair amount with Peter Backwin, and like I tend to, or I shouldn't say this, I'm learning, but I tend to kind of ignore everything except what I'm doing, which is very poor form. Don't do that. And so I've had to discipline myself to eat, drink. But Peter, you know, 1 hour into it, he whips out his fig bar. That's what Peter does. He likes fig bars because they're not that sweet. They have fruit in it. And he just eats one right on the hour, 1 hour in, and he does that the next hour and the next hour and just keeps going. And there isn't this minimalism sense that you're not. I'm just going to take this to one level further. Sometimes I think there's this, what's the word, Hillary? Like, we are bad. Like, we're not good enough. And to not eat is better. There's this odd Puritan undercurrent in our culture that life isn't good. And so we should avoid things that are pleasurable or comfort inducing. And that's, I kind of just leapt off to another level here. But at any rate, Peter and you just, you know, eat. Food is good. It's good for you. Calories out, calories in.
Yeah. And, you know, I think honestly, I think it kind of relates back to that, this whole idea in running that like more is better and less is more. Like the faster you're running, you always want that. Even if you're prescribed an interval workout and you're supposed to hit a certain pace, you want to go faster than that. You want to go under it. Or, you know, it's like, well, what if I, you know, lighter is better. And that's not always the case. It's power to weight ratio. You know, it's like how, you know, and I just think that I think it can be dangerous. And it is, it's kind of like, it's in the running culture, which can be a little bit detrimental, I think, to progress, because there's not one body or size that fits all and leads to performance. And your body, everyone's body is a bit different. And I also think that if you try to trick your body into not eating, you know, your body can actually can go into a starvation state where you break down muscle. Use that as fuel. If you're not eating enough, you break down fat, you break down muscle, which is not good. And then when you are out of a starvation state, like you start eating again, then your body is like, oh, I'm going to eat this food now, but I haven't had it for a while. And you know what happens is you store it as fat. And so you can actually change your body composition. Even if you're trying to like, quote unquote, lean out, eat less calories, get faster and leaner, you're actually working against your own body's physiology and your body will trick you right back.
Well said. That's good. Trick you right back. Food is good. Every living entity takes in food. So we shouldn't think that not taking in food is somehow good. I appreciate that. Now there's a lot of different diets here. Now we can't do, we have to be judicious with this because one cannot possibly solve the diet question. That that cannot be done. There's individuals are different. What they want to do is different, et cetera, et cetera. But there are some, going back to our theme, training myths, I think, around diet. We need to talk about ones like starving yourself, not a great plan. Eating food, a good plan. How about what type? What do you hear that you think is just not that good of an idea?
You know, and so I agree. I think, so my father is a food science human nutritionist, and we've had many conversations about diet and all this stuff. And so he's always been the one that's like been debunking things, you know, at the kitchen, at the dinner table since I was, you know, 9. And so the one thing that all nutrition, you know, researchers can agree on is that there's no one diet fits all. It's just not possible. But the really cool thing is that no matter like where you live, your body can tell you kind of the things that you need. And, you know, if you look at cultural differences, like from around the globe, like people are getting in the nutrients that they need based on their kind of cultural and, you know, regional diets. But I think for running, especially it's sensationalized in the United States, I think adhering to one strict diet is never a good idea. And of course we might have some people who unsubscribe or it's a controversial topic because I feel like diet can almost be like religion. But I think, generally speaking, especially as an ultra runner, if you're trying to do these ultra distances, having a diet that can be very, exclude certain food groups or, it's very strict, I encourage people to kind of to think about that differently, that if you're doing something that's an ultra sport, why in the world would you have a diet that limits you when you literally food and sleep are the two best recovery tools that you can have in your tool belt? So so maybe you can, you know, infer my beliefs on my tendencies for diets based on that. But that's kind of where I want to leave it.
Oh, I was gonna put you on the spot and ask you to clarify something.
You can ask me. It's okay. You can ask me.
I can't.
Me.
You just said you want to leave it there. So now I'm trying to decide if I can ask my next question, which you could pass on if you want. So if I go into Whole Paycheck, aka Whole Foods, and I just love the salad bar because I don't want, you know, I'm kind of the option guy. I want to get what I want, rather than what someone wants to give me, rather than the menu. I want to just select what I want. And there's always this whole section for paleo. And so I'm saying, what's up with this? It's like, supposedly our ancestors didn't eat. And it's like, this is, I'm just going to say something here. This is no logic to it. I mean, literally, there's no science. There's no logic. There's no, they've done training tests and it doesn't actually work. So what is your thought on this iconic diet that has gone by the name of paleo? And it's also the keto diet.
Well, I guess the one liner that I want to say for this is, if you're comparing yourself to a diet that supposedly a caveman ate, caveman only lived till they were 30. So if that's your game plan, go for it.
Okay.
So no, but I do think that it's important to have, you know, fat. Obviously, as an endurance runner, you do use fat. But like the thing with this is that what people forget is that, especially in an ultra endurance race, the fat that you're burning is endogenous. It's fat that you already have stored in your body. You're using as a substrate. It's not anything that you're ingesting in that moment.
That is a key point, very key point. So basically, and by the way, of course, I just did what you were somewhat reluctant to do, went out on a limb and stated my opinion. And so the hate mail might be coming in. But we already did the disclaimer, which is, you know, 10,000 runners, 10,000 diets, which actually that is scientifically valid. And like you said, there's no way. It's literally stupid to think there is one perfect diet for everyone. That's just not ever going to be a thing.
But I did want to mention too, someone like Jeff Browning, right? Like he is a huge supporter of, like, you know, keto or like paleo, but he doesn't just do that only. Like in races, he also eats carbs. So it's a balance of both, and it's figuring out kind of like what works for you. I'm generally against any extreme form. I'm not against a mix of things or like trying things out and seeing what works for you, because, you know, it could work. But I think generally speaking, an extreme mixed with an extreme like ultra running is probably not a good combination.
Well, the scientific application you just mentioned, it was very sharp, I thought, that we were actually burning endogenous fat, which is already there. So if someone is ingesting fat or protein, that will become available like 4 hours later, which is not that big of a help. And so you kind of have to say, well, what is really taking place here?
Yeah. And I mean, that might be helpful in a longer distance, right? Or like, you know, Steve House, he's an amazing athlete. He's a great coach. I mean, you know, but if you think about that training for the uphill athlete, he really talks about fat adaptation and ketosis. And that's very important. And also, like, you think about it, if you're going out for a 3-day expedition and you want to carry calories with you, you know, carrying some, being fat adapted and being able to, you know, to carry that weight and eat fat, like, but they're going to, you know, have time to ingest it, to like then have your body be able to use it and metabolize it. I also think, like, as a runner, if you're trying to run fast, you run fast by using carbs. You can't just forget those.
Right. Well, I'll mention two things here. One is that it doesn't matter what you put in your mouth, you're burning glycogen. I mean, I kind of have to just cut to the chase here. You can put a Twinkie in, you can put in, you know, a goo, you can put in a sirloin steak. doesn't matter. That will be metabolized into glycogen, which is literally the only thing your cells can use. And so my personal logic is, during an event, I want to be as close to that glycogen as I can get, because anything past that is going to take extra work to digest and metabolize. So my race diet is completely different than my everyday diet. Maybe that's one way to look at it, is that when I'm running, I want it to be fast. I want to go hot. I want sugar.
Candy, Buzz, candy.
Chocolate specifically. And then every day, you don't want to do that, because you get diabetic. You get hypoglycemic.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea.
I'll just add on to this one, Hillary, going back to what we said about aging and strength and so forth, is that past year, as well as the past 5 or 10 years, I ingest concentrated protein with every meal.
Yeah, and actually, there's a lot of science.
I bumped it up.
There's a lot of science with that, is that actually even training with protein, but specifically making sure you get in protein after your workout, it actually improves muscle recovery, right? Because you're kind of giving your body the substrate that it needs to rebuild. So it can't just all be about carbs.
I'm a late adopter of the protein shake. It took me long, long time to come around, but I am now a protein shake user.
I love it. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, we could talk forever about this stuff.
Well, we'll talk a few more minutes. I've got another myth that I think pertains to me, some of the things I've done, which is altitude acclimatization, right? Because, Colorado, people talk about this all the time. People come out and do Leadville. The town of Leadville is at 10,000 feet. Of course, Hard Rock, a iconic event that the course actually goes above 14,000 feet. Pikes Peak Marathon, that's got 7,000 feet of vert that goes up a 14er also. And when I'm hearing what people are doing, I'm a little aghast. I just don't think they're quite grasping what is taking place here. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah. So I think people can kind of freak out about it a lot. And there's a lot of different mentalities about altitude training. And it's not that just because I live in Colorado or you live in Colorado that we're just going to be better at altitude. It can actually be kind of a toss up and individualized with people's physiology. I know someone a friend of mine, she's a great runner, like a 230 marathoner. And every time she goes above, 8,000 feet, she gets sick, no matter what. And she's born and raised in Colorado. But, there's ways to kind of to get around it and adapt and train your physiology for it. But I don't think it's necessary to do these huge blocks, I think it is to learn what it's like to run at altitude and to be prepared for a race. If you're running Leadville for the first time, I would definitely recommend going somewhere with high altitude and seeing, how your body responds, if you're, how you can take in nutrition. But it's not something that requires, I don't think, you need to do it for months and months and months at a time.
Well, the science in that is very interesting. So I hear a lot of people, hey, I'm going to do a Leadville, I'm going to do Pikes Peak, do Hard Rock. So I'm going to get out there like a few days in advance, so I'm acclimated. No, you're not. The science on this is actually quite surprising. You will feel the worst 1 to 3 days after coming here. That's your worst time. So for most people, it's actually better to show up that morning and just hit it.
I agree.
This is counterculture. Is
for sure.
Basically, you show up and you just punch it out. And you're actually feeling fine. Your body actually responds to that. It decreases the blood volume, so it increases your hematocrit level. But in 1 to 3 days, no, you're at your worst. So you actually have to come out here for more than 3 or less than 1 day.
And I think also it's so again, it's not like, oh, I'll get there 2 days before that. That's probably the worst thing. But I think it's like, it can be 2 weeks, right? So your body has 1 to 2 weeks, right? Like either show up the day of and then rage, or wait like a week or two and then do the race so that you are, you know, acclimatized more.
Mm-hmm. I've got something from Dr. Tom Hornbein, 1963 West Ridge Expedition. This guy, I mean, major cred. And Tom, you know, person to person, this is quotable. He said, "Buzz, it takes 19 days to make a red blood cell." And I went, "What?" And you know, the gears started clicking and worrying here. So there's two types of acclimatization. There's this, you know, physiological type, your blood pH and your breathing, your respiratory rate and things like that. Like you said, at, you know, 3 to 7 days, you're pretty good on that. But actually to bump your hematocrit and get better performance, which means to utilize the less oxygen that's in the air, that's 3 weeks. Anything less than 3 weeks and nothing is happening in terms of your hematocrit. Between 21 and 28 days, a lot happens. That's why people like Reinhold Messner and, you know, Killian, they went to Everest Base Camp for 3 weeks before they tried their oxygen-less ascents. Because less than that, less is happening than what you might think.
And I also think another thing with acclimatization is like intake of water, right? It's like you do need more water with all of this. And generally speaking, because you're a little bit kind of more dehydrated at high altitude. But a really interesting technique and a training thing that you can do to help acclimatize, something that can actually help if you don't have like access to high mountains to train in, getting in the sauna. Heat training, like physiologically speaking, that's like kind of like a most similar stimulus to what happens when you go up in altitude. It's kind of almost like the thinning of your blood from, yeah.
Right. Surprisingly, that works. I think, as you mentioned, there's a complex set of circumstances that happen when you go up to altitude, like your friend who lives in Colorado goes above 8,000 feet and doesn't feel good. And the saying is always, you know, 1,000 feet per day and go real slow. That's actually to prevent injury or disease, you know, HAPE, HACE, AMS. And you definitely don't want to get high altitude pulmonary edema. This gets, you know, fatal. But those actually take like 4 days. This is really for mountaineering. For what we do for running, racing, those are not a thing. You don't really have to worry about that. So you have to shift gears in terms of running. And I'm going to just put this out, go out on a limb as I tend to do. You know, at 12,000 feet in most weather patterns, at 12,000 feet, there's 40% less oxygen in every breath you take. That's for everybody. Doesn't matter if you're acclimated or not. Everyone is breathing the same air. And I think what happens is if you go up to that elevation, you're suddenly breathing harder and you get freaked out. There's a certain psychosomatic effect and you think that you're screwed, you're doing well, you're dying. Everybody is breathing the same air and you're going to be moving slower, period, no matter how acclimated you are. And so relax, breathe a lot, probably slow down, and things might be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a reason why some of the, you know, the best runners, there's a lot of people that do high altitude camps. So if you really want to practice like running turnover, you have to go down to sea level because you can't really reach that same cadence when you're at high altitude. So there is, you know, or higher altitude, and there is some sort of, you know, balance that has to be, you know, reached at that point. And you're right, like everyone is slowing down at that point. It's a matter of physiology.
Right. That's the old train high. I mean, sleep high, train low. They've kind of tuned that up. There's a little bit of a high, low theory right now, which is you sleep high for that acclimatization, that building your hematocrit. And you do your long, slow, your endurance training also high. But like you said, you do your tempo work low because otherwise you're not doing tempo work because you're moving too slowly.
And recovery is actually easier at sea level, so or below altitude, right?
Right.
That's
right.
Really the hardest thing if you're constantly training high and sleeping high. How are you recovering?
you're getting tired. A friend of mine, we were racing Mount Evans, not on foot. It was a bike race, Mount Evans hill climb. And he decided to go spend the night before on top of Mount Evans. This person who will remain unnamed, but he wrote a famous book on Mount Everest. And he also wrote another famous book on a school bus in Alaska, but I'm not going to tell you who this was. And he went to the top of Mount Evans and spent the night. And we're all going, dude, you don't really want to do this. Your body isn't going to have any positive adjustments in this span of time, but you will sleep poorly and wake up tired.
Yeah, I don't think that that's the best training mentality. It's also maybe it's this whole idea that like the more tired you are, the better trained you are. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Hillary, I think this has been good. I think we've touched on some of our favorite training myths. Anything else that strikes your mind, or is this good enough for now?
I have lots of things, but like, I think we could probably rant on a 5-hour bike ride about this, Buzz.
Okay.
But no, I think this is it for now. And I'm excited to see kind of the feedback. It's fun to chat about. I think it's awesome. And it's a lot of things that I've learned over, you know, my career through a bunch of recovery, a lot of reading. I think it's fun. Hopefully it gives some food for thought. Literally for people.
Food for the thought and the body and the soul. Good one, Hillary. I very much appreciate you. It's always good to talk with you.